Hello and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you and I are having this conversation just a couple of weeks away from the midterm elections, which probably makes this a good time for us to discuss where the Democratic Party, you know, they've been out of power now for a couple of years, and they're salivating at the prospect of taking back one or both houses of Congress, where they find themselves. And you wrote recently at American Greatness that today's Democratic Party, or at least the ascendant progressive wing of the party, is what you called a wolf in wolf's clothing, and that that's sort of in contrast with how they've traditionally done business in the past. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, usually the Democrats assume that the country is a center-right country, so they run on they play down social liberalism and they play up economic issues in hopes of winning the working classes. And that's, some of them are doing that. Some candidates this time around are doing that. And the ones that are doing that are more successful probably. But that party, the Democratic Party, is now sort of a neo-socialist party. And it feels that the Obama paradigm of neo-socialism, identity politics, in association with the unpopularity of Donald Trump, they assume, and also the historic gain of an out party in the first midterm of about 25 seats or so, they feel that they don't have to disguise themselves anymore. So they're really running on the, a lot of candidates on the blue coastal corridors areas are running on the abolition of ICE and universal Medicare for everybody, cancellation of $1.5 trillion in student loans, radical cuts in the defense budget, and mandated curtailment of fossil fuel use. So that's kind of out there. It's just there. I mean, it's not being hidden. It's transparent. It's overt.
You mentioned identity politics in that last answer. Identity politics has been a pretty core part of the Democratic Party's ideology for a while now, but it's difficult to not deny that it has taken on a new kind of intensity of late, both in the terms of, well, I don't know how else you'd put it, than a lot more explicit hostility to whites than you could have imagined in the past. And also, I mean, the sort of reductio ad absurdum of all this, this recent incident in which you had Elizabeth Warren going through a rather bizarre exercise to prove that she perhaps has a vanishingly small amount of Native American ancestry. What does the Democratic Party look like? What does the country look like if this heightened emphasis on identity politics continues apace?
In the left view, it's 30% non-white, but that assumes that we all have DNA badges and we don't intermarry and assimilate and integrate, and that Latinos never vote Republican or blacks never revolt. So that's their theory, that they get the LGBTQT, the feminist, the Latino, the Asian, the black vote, monolithic, and they're all predicated on identity politics. And then you add them all together and you get 51% of the electorate. That's what Obama, they think, that they think that was his legacy. And then meanwhile, you can afford to lose almost 62% Trump of the white vote. But the problem with that is twofold, that that formula wasn't transferable intact to Hillary Clinton on the upside of getting minority voters to vote en masse. But the downside of alienated white voters was, especially in these key states. Because once you go down the tribal road, then in history, people who don't really associate themselves with a particular tribe will do that for their own perceived self-protection, or they feel it's a fad. And so in the United States, there's not really a monolithic white consciousness, because there's Italians, there's Arabs, there's Greeks, there's Armenians, and nobody. But once you say that every group has to self-identify, then you really don't want to do that when the majority is so-called white. And I think that's what the Democratic Party is forcing people to do with this constant monotonous refrain and mantra, white, 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 white power, white privilege, white supremacy, white males, old white men. And people finally just say, if they hate me so much, I might as well do what they do. And that's not good. And as far as Elizabeth Warren, you think that our trusted leaders would not do what every American in theory could do. I mean, we're all about 1% to 2% Native American in some fashion. But most people do not consider themselves people of color who don't have real Indian ancestry. But she did. And she's denied that she did. She's embarrassed herself with her cookbook when she got a French chef's recipe and passed it off as a Native American family recipe of the Warren family. And it's really hard to, in this whole narrative about her Indian ancestry, it's really hard to find anything that's true, is what I'm trying to say. There's just nothing that's true there. And her ancestry is not accurate. Her cookbook's not accurate. The idea that a person who might be as little as 1% or even less is a minority. I mean, African Americans on average are about 23% white. That's 23 times more than Elizabeth Warren's 1%. So if that's the standard that you're going to identify as your predominant ethnic pedigree, a 1% ancestry bloodline, so to speak, then you wouldn't have any African Americans. They would all say, well, we're average 23%, so we're all white, which is fine with me, but I don't think that's what they intend to do.
Victor, there was an impression, which later seemed to be buttressed by a fair amount of polling data, that Democrats really overplayed their hand in the course of the Kavanaugh hearings, and that sort of boomeranged on them. And as a matter of pure politics, this is actually a pretty hard feat to pull off, to fail at the task of trying to block the opposition party's nominee and to still wind up leaving the opposition more motivated than they were before. Give us the autopsy on why this seemed to go so disastrously wrong for the Democrats in the end.
Well, I think that the leadership is reflective of the concentration of power in the foundations, the universities, the media, the elite ranks of the Democratic Party, intellectual, art, Hollywood, entertainment. And that's about 10%. It's a very influential 10%. It adjudicates everything from ESPN to CNN to the latest Hollywood movies or Netflix or Amazon or social media, but it's not the majority of people. So they create this echo chamber that what they're doing is resonating. So if you claw at the Supreme Court door to try to break in, I don't know what they would do when they broke in, attack the family of Kavanaugh, who was there to witness the swearing in. Or if you disrupt the Senate, or if you confront somebody in the elevator, or if you're Cory Booker and you say get into their face, I don't know what they think the effect of that is on most people who don't do such things in their own life. But so they're kind of detached, and then they seem deer in the headlights surprised that they start to bleed support after Kavanaugh, after the demonstrations after Kavanaugh, after the Christine Ford testimony, after the Elizabeth Warren DNA press conference and video, and now with this so-called caravan at the border. All these things were perceived by progressives as confrontational wedge issues that would embarrass the old white in the way Republican Party. But I think as you look at the polls, they've pretty much written off the Senate because of these issues, the way they've handled these issues. And they are losing certainty about the House. The House is starting to look like 2016 race. It really is. Maybe a close popular vote, but a lot of races breaking by one or a half point toward the Republican.
The president, of course, has been voicing his concerns about immigration since back when he was a candidate. He hasn't thus far been able to move on it in a serious way as president, at least not in the sense of getting the border wall built. But as we're talking here, a couple of weeks before the midterms, you've got, as you just mentioned, this massive caravan of people coming up from Central America through Mexico trying to get to the United States. And best I can tell, without going out of my way to be uncharitable here, the Democrats don't really seem to have a response to it. I mean, really, the policy initiative that Democrats have had on immigration that's received the most attention is the one you mentioned earlier, the proposal to abolish ICE. And this is a big shift from – you can go back even to the early years of Barack Obama and find video of him arguing about the importance of securing the border and knowing who's coming in. And Democrats, I suppose, might think that the president is sufficiently inflammatory on this topic that they can just get out of the way and let him hang himself. But do you think that strategy can work when there are still all of these obvious real threats, real issues at the border?
Well, I think they can't square the circle. There's too many factors at play that are not resolvable. One is that you can't have a nation if people, 10, 12,000 foreign nationals, just decide they're going to crash a border. If they choose to do that and they do so with impunity, then anybody can do it. And it makes a mockery of legal immigration, people who are waiting either for green cards or refugee status. So you can't do that and still have a legal, lawful society. The second thing is it's a really bad polling issue for progressives. They poll about 40% support for letting people come in and then claiming refugee status. And they know that, and that's why they're not very vocal. But the third problem is they've mortgaged their principles to their base, their identity, Barack Obama-era base. And a lot of the people in the Latino community and the other sympathetic minority communities want that to happen, as does some of the kingmakers in the Democratic Party who see California flipped blue, Nevada's flipped blue, maybe Colorado, maybe New Mexico for good, maybe Arizona, even Texas. So there's a lot of different interest in seeing open borders. But boy, if you don't have the support of the American people, what you do is just be quiet about it. You don't talk about it, at least in public. And so you don't alienate your base, and you try not to alienate the majority of the population. So they're looking for other news events, such as the one currently about the supposed pipe bombs that were mailed to particular Democratic politicians and, you know, George Soros-type players. That takes away from that issue, because that issue is a losing issue. And that's why Democrats just don't want to comment on it, other than maybe a few progressives that are running for Congress in predominantly, well, I shouldn't say predominantly, overwhelming Democratic districts.
So the final thing that I'll ask you, Victor, we've seen this menacing and kind of illiberal trend in the past few months of people confronting elected officials in public, and not just in the sense of voicing disagreement, but sort of actively harassing people. So you had Jeff Flake being confronted in the elevators on Capitol Hill, or you've had people like Ted Cruz or Mitch McConnell being harassed in restaurants. And you've had certain Democrats, you know, Maxine Waters probably most visibly, who've actually been condoning this trend, if not necessarily any of these specific events, but encouraging partisans to get up in people's faces. And as we're recording this, as you mentioned, we're also getting these ongoing reports of suspicious packages that may have explosives in them being sent to prominent Democrats. So I suppose it's not as if this is a purely one-way street. But there is a sense, Victor, that both the scope of the contempt that each side feels for each other and the means that they will use to express that contempt are expanding, and expanding dramatically and expanding quickly. How concerned are you about political polarization in the current environment?
Well, I wrote an article in the Defining Ideas, kind of a debate with Mo Farina at the Hoover Institution, where I argued that you should be very concerned, and he suggested maybe they're not as worrisome as the media would imply. I think they are, because I think people don't know what the rules are. And with these latest supposed bomb threats, suddenly the left is saying that inflammatory speech, and remember Donald Trump did praise a congressman who body slammed or supposedly pushed a reporter, that type of activity prompted maybe unstable individuals to do something like this, even though we have no evidence. We don't know who did it, why. We don't know if they're left or right or they were political or just terrorist-minded. But nonetheless, then the people that are watching this, the majority of Americans say, well, what are the rules? There's no rules in the arena, because if Eric Holder advises people to be kicked, or Cory Booker to get in their faces, or Hillary not to be civil, or as you said, Maxine Waters, or we have this assassination chic where celebrities, you know, rack their brains trying to figure out whether Trump should be decapitated or drawn and quartered or beat to a pulp or incinerated or, you know, shot. And that's okay, because free speech, and it's rhetorical and it's funny, supposedly, but it wouldn't have real life consequences, such as James Hodgkinson, the person who shot Representative Scalise. So they don't know whether, what's the rules? When the left does it, it doesn't lead to real life consequences, but when Trump or the right say things they probably shouldn't, it does. And I think further, they're willing to say, well, whatever you decide, just tell us. We either have unfettered free speech, and it's kind of tough, but then it doesn't really have an effect on deranged people who are going to do it anyway, or we don't have unfettered speech. And when people threaten to kill the President of the United States, maybe, you know, maybe the Secret Service should report that, and Madonna or Snoop Dogg or Kathy Griffin say, you know what, just go off, just take a time out, get on a terrorist watch list for 90 days, just don't fly. Or when somebody roughs up a speaker at Middlebury, say, you know what, you may have a trajectory to Harvard Law School, but you're going to get a felony on your record for assault. And I think if you were to do that, it would deter, but right now we don't. And so we get outraged over particular, depending on the ideology of the speech and the action. And that's what confuses people and further polarizes the divide.
All right. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the classes, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.